A, I like to be a person, and I like to try to connect on a human level with my audiences. And then one of the messages I like to convey as an astronaut is what a beautiful Earth we live on. And I mean, it's visually beautiful, and I show pictures and movies of just how stunning the Earth looks from the vantage point of the space station or the space shuttle. And the message I try to convey is, gosh, I am so proud to be a citizen of that.
That was Dan Taney. Some kids dream about becoming a doctor. Some want to be president. As a kid, he would pretend to be an astronaut. But Taney never imagined it was a real possibility until he became an aerospace engineer, which led to making the dream a reality. His time in space would open the door to many possibilities.
Everyone has a story to tell. People, places, and international exchange. This is Voices of Exchange.
My name is Dan Taney, and I grew up in Chicago, but not right now. I live in the suburbs of Washington, D.C. Currently, I'm a director of a nonprofit foundation called the U.S.-Japan Foundation, and we are interested in bettering the relationship between the people of the United States and Japan. But for 16 years, I was a NASA astronaut located in Houston, Texas at the Johnson Space Center. You know, I grew up in the 60s, and so like virtually everybody around the world, I would play astronaut and pretend to be an astronaut, think about being an astronaut, but I really had no idea that that was even possible to become an astronaut. You know, I went to public school and graduated, went to university and studied engineering, and my first job out of college was with a big aerospace company in California. And they happened to be making rockets and satellites. So that's exciting. I mean, building satellites is really exciting. So that's the job I chose for my first job. Well, that company had the misfortune of having a satellite that didn't work in space. It got deployed and didn't work on the space shuttle. And so they had to find a team to figure out how to go fix that satellite. And of course, since the company I worked for made the manufacture of the satellite, we got to build the tools and the pieces that the astronauts would use to go fix the satellite. And it was really exciting when the astronauts came and visited our plant and talked to us and discussed what kind of tools they would need. And so I got to meet these astronauts, and it was just an exciting thing to hang out with them for the day and go to lunch with them and talk to them. And then later in my career, at a different company, I worked with more astronauts. And the sort of slow aha moment for me was that by meeting these astronauts and talking to them and getting to know, you know, funny things about them and their families, I realized that they're just they're people with jobs. They're people that have a great job. And I never really thought about that. I never thought about an astronaut as somebody who applies for the job and gets the job. But once I realized that it's achievable to anybody who can fill out the application, that set a seed in my head. So I went back to graduate school and got another job, as I said, in the aerospace industry. And then I heard somebody say, hey, you know, they're taking applications for the astronaut program, and they do that about every 2 years. And so couple guys I work with look at each other and said, well, you know, we'd be stupid not to apply to be an astronaut. I mean, it seems like the greatest job in the world. So we filled out the applications and sent them in. I just got really, really lucky. And out of, you know, thousands of applications, mine got pulled to go for the interview. And out of 120 people they interviewed, I was one of 35 that got picked that year. A huge class of astronauts, but it was quite surprising to me that I made it even as far as the interview, much less getting selected.
Every year, thousands of people apply to become a NASA astronaut. Of those thousands, an elite few are chosen. And Dan Taney was one of them.
I remember the moment distinctly because it's one of those things that you just absolutely remember. And it was January 7th. I remember the date. And I remember I was taking down Christmas lights from my house. And I heard the phone ring, and I heard my wife pick it up. And she said, she handed me the phone and said, it's the chief of the astronaut office, my boss. And there's not many reasons why the chief of the astronaut office would call you on a Sunday afternoon. And so I got on the phone and he said, hey, we're putting a crew together to fly later this year. And we'd like you to be a member of that crew. So it's one of those moments where it's a whirlwind of emotions. It's, you know, it wasn't as shocking to me as getting the call to be interviewed to be an astronaut because, you know, we are selected to be astronauts and we're sort of waiting for the call to get assigned a mission. And we know most likely that we're going to get that call. Of course, it's exciting when it happens. The call to become to come down to Houston for the interview was a complete shock. That was out of the blue for me. And that was a rush of emotions and thoughts and ideas and questions that I, you know, felt I had no way of expressing all of those emotions. But getting the call to be a crew member was fantastic. And then, of course, I wanted to know who I was going to fly with, who my commander was going to be, all that stuff. And it started a whole year of a whirlwind year of training and learning to be a crew member and the anticipation of my first mission.
NASA astronaut candidates go through about 2 years of initial skills training, like spacewalking and robotics, as well as focusing on leadership and teamwork, all of which prepare them to live and work 250 miles above Earth, aboard the International Space Station, also known as the ISS. There, astronauts like Tani take part in experiments that benefit the human race, but they also have some fun capturing special moments and trying new foods, like Dvorg.
You know, when we're in training, at the moment we're selected to be an astronaut, we are knee-deep in data and procedures and regulation and expectations. And so for the year of training, we are so involved in how do we get the space shuttle up into orbit safely? How do we transform the spaceship into the shuttle into an orbiting laboratory? You know, all of the technical things that you have to do, and we take notes and we cram for simulations, and we, you know, we're so involved in the mechanics of getting into space and doing the work that we are expected to do when we're up there. And it's easy to lose the emotion and the philosophical aspect of, wow, they're gonna put me on a rocket and I'm gonna go 17,500 miles an hour. And so even on launch day, you get strapped in, and we are strapped in about 2.5 hours before launch. And so there is a moment when they're getting the rocket, the space shuttle ready to go, where there's not much for us to do. And we fall back into this familiar pattern, the crew does, of joking around and talking to each other, because we do that a lot in the simulations. It feels just like the sim. However, you know, on launch day, it's different, and you know it's different, and I had this feeling like, you know, any minute now, they're going to figure out they made a mistake and chose the wrong guy and come and pull me off this thing, because I don't know why I got fortunate enough to be sitting in this seat and get ready to go into space. But my expectations were mostly technical. My expectations were, on day two, I've got to get that suit ready to go and do my spacewalk. I have to, I'm in charge of all the cameras and all the film back then. It was film. And so I'm in charge of all that. And so my mind was filled with making sure I get my job done. And really the emotional part of it was kind of secondary. But until you light those engines, and boy, it's just a fantastic experience. And then it was, I was trying to be in data record mode. I was talking to myself, don't forget what this is like. Try to remember every moment of this. This is such an amazing experience. I really would like to remember this so I can tell my friends and express to people who will not, or probably not get this chance to do this, that what it's like, because it's just fantastic. So I've had two trips to space, and my first one was for 2 weeks on the Space Shuttle Endeavour. We went to the space station, and it was just a fantastic introduction to space. And but as I mentioned, working on the space shuttle is, you are scheduled every 15 minutes. You're up there for a short amount of time, so they need to maximize the amount of work you do. And so there is very little downtime on a space shuttle mission. Going to space station is much different, and for me, a huge pleasure, because now you live in space. That's now it's your home for those few months. And we work hard. We work 5.5 day weeks, but there are moments where there are days where you have nothing scheduled, because that's what a resident would do. And so Sundays and half a Saturday were just fantastic, because now I could go to the window. I could just sit in the window for hours and watch the Earth roll by. I could look at all my pictures and sort of do all the administrative stuff that you do have to do on Earth, but you get to do it in space. So for me, my space station mission was a real pleasure. I got to make a home out of the space station. I got to find my favorite places to hang out. Sometimes it can get warm up there, and so you know where the cool places are to hang out. You can look at your predicts for the next week and see where you're going to be flying over, and, oh, I'm going to go over Paris. And so you can set the alarm on your watch so that you can go take some pictures of Paris or some other place that you want to see on Earth. And so life on the space station for me was just fantastic. Now, I was up with a crew of three. My boss, the commander, was Peggy Whitson, and then my other flight engineer was cosmonaut Yuri Malenchiko, and the three of us got along really well. Peggy is a very accomplished astronaut. She's a classmate of mine, so we knew each other for quite a long time, and she's a farm girl from Iowa, so I learned a lot about farming and very difficult things that farmers have to do. And then Yuri had a daughter about the age of my children. And so it was wonderful to connect with him about how his daughter was doing and how he communicates with his wife and children. And so we had a lot to talk about there also. So as a community, as a crew, I could not ask for a better crewmates, and we really, I think, enjoyed each other's company, and we got a lot of work done too. What's really interesting is I get the question a lot, which is, you know, when you were in space, what foods did you crave? What did you really, you know, what were you missing in space? And my answer is pretty much nothing. I mean, the food up there was delicious, and I did not sit around and crave, oh, I wish I had, you know, this or that. Eating in general is very important, and NASA, all the space agencies understand the morale importance of food and how it's you always want to look forward to something that you're going to eat, and also the social environment. Peggy was fantastic in mandating that we have dinners together, and that was important family time for us. And so, yeah, we feel food is very important. When I was on the space station, and it's still true now, half the food is donated, or half the food is provided by the NASA system, the American system, and half is provided by the Russians. And so when we get to the dinner table, we can choose whichever one we eat, and it's just sort of what you have to be hungry for during that at that time. Or also you look at your pantry and you say, hey, we're loaded up here on the beef stew. We got to start eating down this beef stew. I liked all of it. There are very few things that I wouldn't eat. There are a couple cans of meat that the Russians provided that just didn't sound good to me. And so as long as my Russian counterpart, my Russian crewmate Yuri would eat them, I didn't feel badly about not eating some of those Russian cans of food. But some of the Russian stuff was fantastic. I would say my favorite thing in space is this sweet cheese that Russians have There's a sweet cheese that the Russians have called dvork, and it's, think of it like the cheesecake. It's that sort of sweet cheese, they have it both in cans, which is delicious, and they also have it powdered, and you add water and you mix it together. And we would take some strawberries and rehydrate them and put them on the dvork, and it was like a cheesecake. I really miss that. I have not had dvork since I've been back to Earth. The irony is, when I got back to Earth, there is space food that I still crave. And so it's a surprise to people to find out that I sit at home and I go, first of all, that dvork, I would love to eat some dvork. And there is real pleasure in when a new spacecraft would come up, it would bring fresh vegetables and fruit for us. And one of the things that Peggy would do is she would take an apple and she would eat apple and peanut butter, which I had never seen before. But I love that now. And now every time I get an apple, I'll slice it up and I'll put peanut butter on it. It brings me right back to being on the space station. I would say the whole experience of being an astronaut has been very good for me. Of course, learned a lot about what I am capable of doing and what I am incapable of doing, where I was able to refine the boundaries of what I was able to help define the boundaries of what I have the capability and interest of doing and what I don't, but also what my job is, what my role is in the team, and how to best help the team. Really, as astronauts, one of the most important things I learned is the importance of teamwork. And I know everybody talks about teamwork as important, but the astronaut program and NASA really focuses on that. We do specific training on teamwork, and I don't think that I would understand how teams work and what my role in any given team would be if I was not an astronaut, because we focused on it so much. And so now I think about leadership and teamwork all the time, because I think that was the culture of what we were taught and what we were asked to be really good at as astronauts and crew members on a space mission. So I think that's what I've really learned. It wasn't particularly being in space. It was the whole process of training to be a crew member, both on the space shuttle and on the space station. And those are skills and ideas that I take with me every day in my life, both professionally and personally. You know, I lived in Japan for a couple years, and you'd be on the subway, and it's packed, and you're in the middle, and the doors open, there are 20 people are going to try to get on, and there's hardly a room for one person to get on. And what that team needs right now for you standing in the middle is for you to shuffle over 3 inches so that the next guy can shuffle over 4 inches so you can make room. And I think of leadership like, you know, my job, but the team right now is this car of people. And the thing I can do to help this car of people right now is to squeeze into the corner a little bit more so that more people can squeeze in and we can get 2 or 3 more people onto the car. And I really now think about, how do you help the team? And what does the team mean? Is it my family? Is it my community right now? Is it, and a lot of time it's the world. And what can I do? What's my role in the world? And what can I do best to help that team?
Tawny has had the opportunity to travel the world as a U.S. speaker, but a real point of pride for him is something bigger.
My interaction with the State Department is I've been privileged to be a participant in the speakers program. And as part of that program, I've gotten to visit Japan and Portugal and Egypt, Ethiopia, Morocco. It's been fabulous. And I've done virtual visits to Malta and Madagascar. It's just been a wonderful experience for me. I mean, these trips have really allowed me to grow in ways that I would not have been able to, or experience things that I would not have been able to. One of the thoughts I have is, and it was not with a State Department trip, but I was asked to go overseas and speak at an American school or an international school at a commencement. And I'd never been in an international school before. I'd never seen an international school. And it was fantastic. It was in Germany. It was just wonderful. The people were great and the students were having a great time. And the languages they spoke and the diversity of the student body, it was just fantastic. That set a seed in my head, which 2 years later turned into me bringing my family to Japan because I wanted my kids to do an American school experience. And so we went to Tokyo and my kids attended the American school there. And I actually taught at the American school there. That was the vehicle that I was able to bring my family to Japan. So, I mean, I think that's a big ripple effect. I have heard anecdotally of people that have come to listen to me speak and now really want to work as an engineer or want to work in the space industry. And that's fantastic. Whenever I hear those stories, I'm amazed that I had that just my presence, just hearing my story, allowed people to dream a little bit bigger or to widen their horizon a little bit more to things that are possible. I'm warmed by that. I think that's a wonderful response to hearing me speak about space. As an American, I feel so privileged in all the opportunities that I've been given and the fantastic place that I get to live and the fantastic the amenities of being an American. I never want to take it for granted. So typically, I'm the astronaut. So they want to see rockets fly and they want to see people floating around and they want to see what it looks like, what the Earth looks like from space, and they want to talk about exploration. And so I really like to just tell my story and show them what it's like to be inside the space shuttle when it's launching and what it feels like to put the helmet on and go out on a spacewalk. And I think the message I try to convey is basically I was pretty much like most of my audience. I wasn't born into, great wealth nor privilege. In fact, my family, my parents were imprisoned by their government just for being Japanese or having Japanese ancestry. They were native born US citizens, but their parents were Japanese. And so, that seems like a real deterrent, or that seems like you're really starting from far behind to end up to go into space. And so I like to try to connect and be as human as I can to my audiences so that maybe they can connect with, hey, he's to have that idea that I originally had, which is, hey, this is just a person. And they have a great job and they've done some incredible things. And maybe that's something that I can do. Yeah, I say that, sort of the real point of pride for me is that the irony of my parents had their cameras and their radios taken away from them because they were not trusted with radios and cameras. Yet just one generation later, that same government spent a lot of money teaching me how to use cameras and radios. And it's a real point of pride, not only for my the Japanese Americans or my heritage, but it's also a real point of pride for my government that we have been able to we've been able to address that black mark in our history and reconcile it. And so I'm very proud of both my community and my government for getting to where we are now. So I like to be a person, and I like to try to connect on a human level with my audiences. And then one of the messages I like to convey as an astronaut is what a beautiful Earth we live on. And I mean, it's visually beautiful, and I show pictures and movies of just how stunning the Earth looks from the vantage point of the space station or the space shuttle. And the message I try to convey is, gosh, I am so proud to be a citizen of that. And, you know, we all have memberships that we like to adhere to, and sometimes they conflict. But you know, when it boils down to it, what's your real membership? And for me now, it's being a citizen of the planet. And so I try to shrink all of our experiences down to, we all live here. This is our home. And you know, we speak different languages and we eat different food. If we can see ourselves as mostly the same, you know, maybe some of the problems that we're experiencing can be a little bit less. We're not going to eliminate all pain and all suffering, but if we can all feel like we're all in this together, you know, maybe our attitudes can change a little bit, and we can have a better attitude about each other. And so, you know, I would love for all the people on Earth to feel like Earthlings, and carry the, you know, wear the badge of being an Earthling, and feel like that's the club that they belong to, and that's what fills me with optimism after coming back from space, and that is what I want to share with the people of Earth.
We would like to thank Dan Tani, astronaut, director, father, and good citizen of the planet, for sharing his stories with us. And thank you, our listeners, for tuning in. If you haven't yet, don't forget to subscribe to Voices of Exchange wherever you get your podcasts. And be sure to tell your friends, too. Voices of Exchange is a bi-monthly podcast brought to you by the Office of Alumni Affairs and the Bureau of Educational and Cultural Affairs at the U.S. Department of State. Our team includes Desmond Ferris, Asha Bay, Maria Iliadis, and Emily Rand. Have a question or suggestion? Email us at voicesofexchange@state.gov or reach out to us on Instagram @voicesofexchange.